Let's start in Jeremiah 51. I am actually trying to speed us up a little bit in Revelation. We spent so long on chapter 13. Who knows how long we spent on that? I was like, you know what? We need to go a little bit faster. And even Bill had to come tell me, Eric, you're slow, man. That's not really what he said. No. But really, I am trying to speed this up a little bit. I want to finish up Revelation 14 today. Jeremiah 51, 6 through 10. Flee from the midst of Babylon. Let everyone save his life. Be not cut off in her punishment, for this is the time of the Lord's vengeance, the repayment he is rendering her. Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand, making all the earth drunken. The nations drank of her wine, therefore the nations went mad. Suddenly, Babylon has fallen and been broken. Wail for her. Take balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. We would have healed Babylon, but she was not healed. Forsake her and let us go each to his own country. For her judgment has reached up to heaven and has been lifted up even to the skies. The Lord has brought about our vindication. Let us declare in Zion the work of the Lord our God. Sharpen the arrows. Take up the shields. Right? In Revelation chapter 14, even though we've talked a lot about Babylon, Revelation chapter 14 is the first time Babylon makes an appearance in Revelation. And it's a short appearance. Right? Babylon, there's a lot of focus on Babylon, you know, in a short bit, in just a few chapters away. But at this point, it's actually very short. All right, but these readers, if they are readers of the Old Testament as well, when they read about Babylon, they're gonna hear these echoes. They're gonna remember their Old Testament and go, ah, yes, Babylon, the persecutor of the saints, the one who took our people into captivity. Revelation 14. So we've already spent some time in this chapter. Last week we went through an exercise in thinking through the internal logic of the chapter. Remember the paragraph breaking exercise we did? I thought that was useful. We're going to now go through it and discuss things. Let's read a few pieces at a time. Revelation 14, starting in verse 6. Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead, and an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water. Now remember last time we discussed this bit, proclaim to those who dwell on earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. Remember, there's two choices there. There's the choice of the ESV, which I'm reading, which is to equate the earth with every tongue, nation, tribe. And I don't think that's defendable myself. It should be to the land and to the every tribe, tongue, nation. It's Jew versus Gentile, once again. Some other things to note here, all right? But first, I'm going to ask you a question. Is the gospel good news to everyone? No. Not even in a sense of, well, some people don't think it's good news. Reality is, the good news, in its totality, has some very bad news in it. All right? I'll give you an example, then we'll come back to that. Josephus, if you read him, remember Vespasian? Who's Vespasian?
He was one of the emperors that was a short timer.
He wasn't a short timer. Well, who was he? What did he do? He started the war. Well, he didn't start the war. He was the general, right, in charge of executing the beginning of the war against the Jews. When he became emperor, all right. When he became emperor, okay, Josephus talks about the evangelion, the good news of him being made emperor. Okay? This you know, we've talked about this before. Words like king, words like savior, words like gospel, all right? When you say them in a Christian context in the Roman Empire, those are implicit, sometimes explicit critiques of the world system. All right? When Vespasian becomes emperor, was that good news? Well, it depends. It was not good news to the people he killed to get into that spot. All right? The gospel is the same way. The gospel of the fact that Jesus has become king, all right, is the same way. All right? Is it good news for his followers? Absolutely. It is terrible news for all who would oppose him. All right? A few weeks ago, we talked about Cambodia in the afternoon, after the afternoon service. The killing fields. All right, what's the right emotion to feel when you hear about the killing fields? What are the right emotions?
Revulsion.
Revulsion, sadness,
anger.
All right. If there is no judgment, there is no justice, right?
That's right.
If there is no judgment, there is no justice. The good news of Jesus becoming king is not just through faith you may have your sins forgiven. Part of the good news of Jesus becoming king and everything that God's doing is the defeat of evil.
Amen.
All right? That's a part of it. You can't take all the judgment-y stuff out of Christianity. If you lose that, you lose justice. All right? There is justice in it. Very much so. And this is a whole lot about justice and judgment. And so here it talks about this eternal gospel. The context here is primarily judgment. Not good things, but bad things on the wicked. So go back to the text. Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead or in the sky with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the land and to every nation and tribe and language and people. And he said with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. And worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water." This is a little bitty note. This might actually make a whole lot more sense in Cambodia than it would here. What's the importance of springs of water? Right? You can survive there, right? I never have to worry about getting fresh water, right? I can get it anywhere, all right? Ancient world, that's not true, right? You've got cisterns sometimes. Maybe you have to dig a well, and that's a whole lot of work. Maybe if you're lucky, you will find a fountain. You will find a spring, a freshwater spring, all right? That might be one reason why, like the ancient Greeks would often, when they find a spring, they must assume there's some sort of god there or something, because it's so good, right? It's like fantastic. And so it's just interesting to me when it focuses here on the springs of water. I don't ever think about springs of water in my life. I'm like, I've got water fountains, you know, I can go home, I can go in there, turn the water on, boom, it's there. They live in a different world than us, which I think is interesting. Three messages from three angels. That's the first one. The second one is this. Another angel, a second, followed, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality." One thing that's going to come into mind whenever you read this, Babylon and fallen, you're going to think back to Jeremiah. You're going to think about to the promises of judgment against Babylon. All right. Even though I will once again make the argument that this is Jerusalem when we get there, at this point in the narrative, it's not clear. Who's Babylon? All right. Whatever she is, she's bad. All right. And part of God's message is, all right, part of the message from the angels is, she is going to die. Okay? Now, some might at this point, when it talks about the sexual immorality, might go back to lots of discussions of this in the Old Testament about Israel. They might go there and go ahead and make that leap. But at this point, it's not altogether clear. The third message. And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest, day or night, these worshippers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name." And remember, we had some discussion last week on whether we should have a paragraph break here. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. "And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them." First of all, note we have now a contrast of wines, right? Second message, what's the message of, what's the wine there? Well, this is the wine of Babylon, all right? She made all the nations drink. Third message, you have another wine. God is also going to make the nations drink wine. But it's a very different type of wine, right? Culturally speaking, why is there a discussion of mixing of wine? Why would that be relevant? I mean, who goes to a restaurant these days, orders wine, then pours it in their water glass with half, you know, dilutes it? Who does that? We don't do that, okay? But why is that relevant to mention here? Anybody?
Well, they used to do that.
They used to do that.
They used to dilute it. Mm-hmm. He's pouring this out full strength.
Mm-hmm. It was really normal for them to dilute their wine. This makes your wine go farther, right? Beneficial. But also purifies the water, right? Kills those germs, which had poor sanitation. That's useful. He points this out here because he said, "I'm going to pour out the wine. And you might be used to the wine watered down." Uh-uh. Full strength. Not mixed. All right? So this would have... This is actually totally relevant for them to point out. It's not... For us, it might be superfluous. We might read that and go, "Oh, he just means it's really strong." And it's like, no, actually for them, this is a practice. And he's like, "No, not this time. Full strength. All of it's coming." All right, kids. The young ones. All right, here's a big word for you guys. All right, young people. What does it mean to annihilate?
Destroy utterly.
Destroy utterly. Okay? There's one theological topic, all right, that's worth discussing. Is what happens when the sinner dies? What's the judgment like? There's lots of passages in the New Testament where you can look at them and you can go, you know what? That actually doesn't look eternal. It looks like there's a very bad punishment and then they perish and they go away. That's hard to argue here. All right? Let's read the text. Verse 9. "And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever." All right, could just be the burning refuse, but it goes on. "Smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever, and they have no rest, day or night, these worshippers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name." I bring this up because this is a discussion in terms of biblical theology that's totally worth having, and we're not going to go into it much here. If you read the descriptions of destruction in the Gospels. a lot of that really can be taken as temporary, in the sense of the punishment happens and then it's over. All right, and there's a good number of Christians and some people potentially here that think this is actually a viable possibility. The question is, what does that? How do you make of that in light of this? It's kind of hard, all right, because this seems to be a focus on not something temporary but actually permanent. Of course, the discussions you would have to have on this would be, okay, is this permanent just for these particular people, or is this a general statement as a whole? Something to think about in your study, all right, as you're going through. We're not going to dwell on it today, but for the annihilationists, there's a number of good verses to look at. For the non-annihilationists, this would be a good verse to look at to say, this looks eternal, not temporary. Notice, we are continuing the theme of the mark, right? In chapter 13, we had the second beast, and the second beast was trying to get the people to get the mark of the beast on their hand or on their forehead, okay? In earlier chapters, and then in chapter 14, in contrast, there's those who have the mark of the Lamb. All right, the mark of God, His faithful. At the beginning of the chapter, they're standing on Mount Zion. Okay, they're standing on Mount Zion, and now we're continuing that same discussion where the angel comes and says, "You thought, you know, that they were persecuting you, trying to make you become one of them. I'm telling you now, God is coming to judge those who have the mark of the beast." All right, and so therefore, when you get to verse 12, here's the call for the endurance. They're persecuting you so that you would follow Rome. But here's the call for endurance. All right? Keep the commandments of God and faith in Jesus in the middle of persecution. And following right on it, same theme. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, this is like a confirmation of that very last statement, right? Voice from heaven confirming, "Write this, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their deeds follow them." It's not just rest. Their deeds follow them. They are building treasure in heaven. All right? It's just another way of saying that. And so the message of 13 is, you know what? This is the second beast, the land beast. It's trying to get people to follow Rome. All right? And they're going to persecute you. That's a problem. All right? But God says, be faithful. All right? This is what endurance looks like. Not giving in. What endurance is, you keep the commandments of God, even until you're martyred. Right? You keep it. Blessed are you if, when you're trying to keep the faith, you're killed for it. Blessed are you. You know what? Because then you'll have rest and your deeds will follow you. All right? Your deeds will follow you. There's the flow of a thought there. Makes sense? Three messages. Here comes another three. Verse 14. "Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man." Who is this? What's that? It's Jesus, one like a son of man, seated on a cloud, with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, "Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe." So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. A few things to note here, all right? Where is Jesus right now? Where was he last in Revelation?
I missed the golden candlesticks.
There's something more. There's something closer. Where was he? Anybody? Revelation 14, chapter 1, verse 1.
Mount Zion?
Yes. "Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads." Why do I mention this? Well, same thing whenever we've talked about Daniel before. All right, the image in Daniel is you have the Ancient of Days, okay? The Ancient of Days, who is God the Father. And then you have one like a Son of Man going to the Ancient of Days. The image is one of ascension, right? Because he's not just going to the Ancient of Days, he's going to the Ancient of Days to receive a kingdom. All right? What's that? On a cloud, right? On a cloud. Interesting that this is exactly what you have. The last place that Jesus was mentioned in Revelation is on Mount Zion. Where is he now? He's on a cloud receiving a kingdom. All right? One like a Son of Man. This is an intentional reference back to Daniel, right? That when you say one like a Son of Man on a cloud, it's really obvious. This is going back to the Gospels. This is going back to Daniel. So first of all, notice that. All right, you've got Jesus now in the act of ascending. All right? He has a crown, right? Crown says king. Crown says ruling. All right? So then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a Son of Man, with a golden crown on his head, and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud. You know, there's been a lot of stuff happening in the temple of God so far, right? Remember when we had, remember the slain saints under the altar? Okay. Remember the angel taking fire from the altar and throwing it to the earth? All right, this is the same location, all right? Jesus is ascending, and an angel comes out of the temple, all right? Comes out of the temple and says to the Son, it is time now to reap. That's the image. Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come. For the harvest of the earth, or of the land, is fully ripe. So he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped, or the land. Right. Look in your Bibles. Does anybody happen to have a little bitty note on very end of verse 15 on ripe? An alternate translation.
Dried.
Dried. What translation are you using? King James, okay. New American.
I would say it's, yeah, in the text it says right, but the footnote says dry.
Dry up.
What you got there, Michael?
Just, I have a note that says it could mean to dry up.
What translation is that?
It's ESV.
ESV? Oh, mine didn't have that.
Dried.
Your King James, right? New American Standard also has as a footnote, and so, at least in some editions, dried. I just find that interesting, because is he trying to say that the harvest is ready? Or is he trying to say, I'm done planting here? The harvest has dried up. You see the different implications? One's a, it's ready. One's a, I'm done getting fruit from here right now.
Mm-hmm. You know, by us, we still have some land that gets harvested, but they don't harvest it until it's dry, because it's not ready to be harvested.
Okay.
And if you harvest it when it's green, it's not, you lose, you know,
you lose something.
It's not time.
Yeah. What's interesting here is, and because last time we had some discussion of how does this relate to the gospel, I think it was afterwards we, some of us had a discussion, how does this relate to the gospel parables about reaping? All right, and I find it interesting that they don't use this word. All right, it's all the translations, everyone I've ever seen, put it as ripe. All right, and then some of them put a footnote for dry. It could be exactly what you're saying. Very possible. I'm bringing it up just as a, I'm curious, and I say that genuinely as a, I'm curious. I actually don't know, really don't know the answer. But
the word is different?
Yeah, it's actually different. For some of those options, if you're interested, we won't go into them. But Mark 4, for example, and then Mark 13 is the parable of the weeds and the wheat, right? The devil coming and sowing the weeds. It's an interesting question. Thematically, either of them fit. But they could, right? If the dryness here is meaning it's drying up, that does have a different tone to it.
Either way,
Yes. The time to harvest is now, and one like the Son of Man will now put in his sickle to do so. Let's see, is there anything else to note on this one? Let's see. Now, notice, well, you'll notice here a second, right? There's two harvests here, all right? This one is positive or negative?
This is positive.
I think it's positive, right? It seems to be the point. The next one that we're going to have is definitely not positive, all right? Now we are reaping the crop. I mean, because reaping crops, right? That's good, right? That's good. But soon, we will have a something that's not happy. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sickle. And another angel came out from the altar, the angel who had authority over the fire. We've seen this guy, I think, right? Because this, I'm assuming, is the same angel from before who brought the fire from the altar to throw to the earth. I assume, doesn't specify. But the angel has authority over the fire, and he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle. Put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. Not dry, to be clear here. That's, you certainly would not harvest grapes when they're dry. That wouldn't make any sense. That's raisins, right? So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. Okay? So this one's not positive, clearly. All right? Note, once again, going back to our trying to figure out, you know, think through the context here, right? When you've got here, you've got put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth or from the vine of the land, right? In all of Jesus' parable, who's the vine? Israel's the vine. Israel's the vineyard, all right? Now, if you take this as futurist and universal, then you don't go this way. But if you take this as past and talking about Jerusalem in AD 70, you read this and you go, okay, what is the vine of the land? Well, the vine of the land is Israel itself. Now, one thing I think that's very interesting is this number 1,600 stadia. Anybody think about that? 180 miles, okay.
1,600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Probably not the same thing as that. This is a different number, right? We've had some numbers, various numbers repeated, all right? Some of them are like tens. Some of them are like sevens. Some of them are thousands, all right? This one's 1,600 stadia, all right? What's going on with that, all right? Or about 180 miles, all right? Any thoughts? I know you've thought about it some since last time, because we read the text. Huh? Which is not 1,600 stadia.
No.
Yeah, that's a few. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what is that image supposed to provoke?
A river of blood.
Lots of blood, right? We've got war cavalry coming in, all right? How much blood? It's so much blood. It's even on the horses. Not just on the feet. I assume. I've never been in ancient warfare. Right? My assumption is, all right, is anybody? My assumption is you're on a battlefield. There's going to be lots of blood. I would assume, especially on the feet, right? Because it's going everywhere. You know, yeah, that whole thing. Horses spattered in blood. Well, that's going to happen too. You know, they took their horses into battle. But still, the idea is it's blood everywhere. That's the thing. But what about the 1,600 stadia?
How big is the land?
That's a good question. Well, as a matter of fact,
how long is the Valley of Armageddon?
If not that big, I don't think so. If you measure from the southern part of Israel to the very northern part of Israel, guess about how big it is? It's about 1,600 stadia. Now, as an image, what is that trying to tell you?
The whole thing is desolated. The whole thing is.
Yeah. There's going to be blood everywhere. This is going to be a major, major war. All right? Now, did you have your hand up?
Yeah. In my Bible, I've got a footnote that says 1,600 stadia is about 184 miles.
Mm-hmm. That's about right. And just because I wanted to do this, and you can, right? If you have Google Maps on your phone, at least the iPad app, you can actually go in there and you can measure that. And I did it. I'm like, really? And so I went and measured. I'm like, yeah, that's actually about right. That is pretty good. 1,600 stadia. Maybe it's a coincidence. But I don't think so. I think that's kind of the point of this, is to say, there's going to be blood everywhere. Well, not everywhere. Where? For about 1,600 stadia.
In the land.
The land, right? It fits. And I don't think it's a stretch. I think it's actually, oh, okay. Well, I think that's definitely there. If you're wondering, a one stadion is 607 feet. Just in case you're curious. If you want to do the math. Okay, so back to the text. Then another angel came out of the temple. Let's read it again. And he too had a sharp sickle. And another angel came from the altar, the angel who has authority over the fire. And he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle, "Put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth where its grapes are ripe." So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. Now, if you want to be super literal with this, and even the dispensationalists will often not be super literal with this because it's ridiculous, the idea of 1,600 stadia worth of land actually being several foot high of blood, all right? Even Walvoord, all right, the great dispensationalist commentator, wouldn't go that far and say, yes, this will literally happen, all right? Certainly in the ancient world, there was not that much blood. In the modern world, billions of people, there's not that much blood, all right? This is 180 miles just north-south, all right? It doesn't work. It's an image, right? It's not to be taken literally. It's an image. You could think of it as a river, all right? Right? That works, I guess. But really, I think the primary image is just that. It's 1,600 stadia, the land. The whole thing is ultimately going to be devastated. And of course, the grape, right? The grapes, the wine, that's that same image. Red like blood, okay? Why do you think it says trodden outside the city? Did you notice that? Why that detail? Mm-hmm. That's where he was crucified. There are various things that had to be done outside the camp, for example, in the Old Testament, right? Hebrews makes a point of, where did Jesus die? He died outside the camp, right? I think it's related to that. I don't know why exactly. Maybe it's just because that's where that judgment would happen. The scapegoat would not die in the camp, right? The scapegoat was taken very far away from the camp. So I don't really have an answer for that, except for that seems to fit with that theme. But that's all I know. Okay.
So the two words arrive for this one?
Yeah. Yeah. And it really could just be exactly what Pam said. There may be no significance to it at all. It could absolutely be just the grain is starting to dry. It's done from its green phase. And it's time to be harvested. All right, could absolutely be it. And all the translations go that way. But some of them have that little pang of conscience of, or dried, I don't know. They're like, because it really is, it's super unusual. There's There was no instance in the New Testament of that word being used for anything other than dried up. No other instance where it was used in a reaping context. Usually dictionaries, the Greek dictionaries, will be really good for this. And so I went to check. I looked at a general ancient Greek lexicon, and then I looked at one specifically for New Testament Greek. And there was no hint of that. And even the New Testament, when mentioned this passage, and when it mentioned it, it just said it's in the section of dried up. And so it's an interesting note. I don't know exactly what to do with it.
Observation too, if you know anything about grape harvesting, it's pretty much they don't pick individual grapes. That's not the way it's done.
Cluster.
They're snipped off. Mm-hmm. And even if they're planning to make raisins, they don't go pick them off. Those just are set aside and dried. So the harvest all takes place whenever it's ripe.
Yeah. And to be clear, the two harvests are different, right? They're different also in the sense of time, it seems, right? But there is no hint of dryness in the second one. It really is just in the first one. Yeah.
One element missing in this vision is what's done with the weeds.
Well, there's no weeds in this one, yeah. Right?
It alludes to the parable that tears the field.
It certainly can, right? Because you do have two, right? You have the wheat, but you don't have the weeds have now become vines, right? To fit with that theme with the vine of the land. But it is theologically 100% consistent with that, right? It's, you know, if you think about this in a first century context, all right? It's what's being stated here theologically. What's being stated here theologically is those who have followed Jesus, right? Those who have followed Jesus and have refused to get the mark of the beast, all right? God is reaping, all right? They have ripened. They have, if we go with that one, they success, all good, all happy. No notion of bad things there. The harvester has done his work, all right? The harvester has done his work and will receive the proceeds from his toil. The Son of Man, one like a Son of Man on the cloud, right? That's done, but then separately, all right, now that they are removed, now it is time to deal with the vine or the tares, right? And, you know, when you think of the wheat and the tares in Jesus, all right, we tend to think of that as end of time things, all right? When this right here is not an end of time thing. And really fits very well with that Jeremiah passage. If you go back in Jeremiah, what does God tell the saints in Babylon? God says, get out of there. All right? This is after Babylon has been reigning and well after they've conquered Jerusalem. If you go back and read more of Jeremiah, that chapter, he's like, it's time, Jews, faithful Jews, get out of Babylon. Persia is about to come knocking on the door. All right? Get my people out of there. And that's exactly what you've got with the Olivet Discourse in Luke, right? When you see armies starting to surround Jerusalem, get out of Dodge. All right? You don't want to be here when this happens. And then historically we know that's what it's said. The Christians left Jerusalem because they did not want to participate in this war. And so there was, in fact, a reaping. All right? And they survived, and that was good. And then there was another reaping, and it was bad and very bloody up to 1600 stadia specifically. Which is interesting. So it's like what's in the Gospels. Is it purposely trying, right? Is it purposely trying to lead you there? All right? When John is saying this, are the parables of Jesus in the back of his mind in terms of sowing and reaping? Maybe. Maybe.
Eric, could I?
Yeah.
Said this earlier, but it's probably worth reminding everybody because for all this to work, which to me it does, you have to be convinced at an early date for this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if, you know, for the futurists, right, this is just talking about a future thing. And it works. It's not like it can't work. It's just, I think it misses a lot. Right? I mean, whenever I heard of 1600 stadia, it was always just, wow, look at this big area that there was going to be all this blood. And then you find out, oh, this just happens to be the size of Israel. Well, that's just one more of a lot of little bitty pieces of data that point in this general direction. Just one among many. The next thing, all right, to look forward, and then we'll be dismissed. The next thing is the seven angels with the seven plagues. All right? We'll see a lot of similarities, all right, with the seven plagues and the seven bowls as we did with the seven trumpets. All right? And then right after that, we get back to Babylon. All right? Chapter 17, chapter 18 is all sorts of Babylon. And so if when someone was listening to this for the first time, their ears might perk up when they hear Babylon in chapter 14. Go, wait, who is this? Right, who is this? Because the beast needs to be judged too. All right, both beasts, all of those beasts need to be judged. And so it's totally legit to, at this point, wonder, wait a minute, who is this Babylon here? Is this Rome? Could this be the land beast? Could this be Jerusalem? Both need to be judged, and both will get judged, right? Later on, then, we've already talked about Babylon a lot. Later on, that really, the writer goes into more detail, and then Babylon becomes front and center in the narrative. Any other thoughts, questions, disagreements? So next time, read 15. Get familiar with it, and six. Well, the whole book, obviously, but read 15 and 16 because those will be the things we cover next. All right. Cool. Rhonda, will you pray for us, please?